This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Sam Sanders has been talking with people about COVID-19, George Floyd, race, politics, but he talks about food and entertainment. He talks about his family, and he really likes to laugh. Sam, if you don't know, is an NPR correspondent, and he's host of the talk show and podcast It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. He was part of NPR's team during the 2016 election, and he was co-host of NPR's Politics podcast. In January of 2017, he worked with us at CAP Radio on an NPR project called A Nation Engaged. So CAP Radio is adding Sam's talk show to the Saturday schedule. You're going to hear a little more about that in just a bit. But he and I had some time to talk yesterday. He was at his home in Southern California. I was at my home in Sacramento. And when we started chatting, I asked Sam how he finds himself describing what's going on in our country right now.
You know, the way that I talk about it with family and friends and also guests of the show, I like to think of 2020 as actually 3 or 4 years at once. When it comes to race relations, we're living in 1968. When it comes to our economy and this recession we're in, we're living in 1929. When it comes to the pandemic, the most similar moment is perhaps the Spanish flu of 1918. And so I think the only way for me to conceptualize what this year is to understand that we are living many years at once. And it's actually not normal to have all of these things go on at the same time. And when I tell myself that, it helps me be a little more graceful to myself and say, it's all right to feel completely overwhelmed because, gosh, that's a lot of stuff.
Grace is a good word. I think part of the challenge right now is for each of us to recognize how we are doing with all of this. You know, when we're too overwhelmed or too much in a bubble.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, we're getting to that point. I'm sure you can recall when the lockdowns began for coronavirus, there was this kind of spirit of how much can we achieve while locked in our homes or apartments? I'm going to learn how to cook. I'm going to learn a language. I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to do this. And I'm going to homeschool my kids. And everyone realized a few weeks into that, that's impossible. And perhaps the best that we can hope for right now is to get through this year intact. Because it's a lot to deal with. And I think that universally we have come a long way since early March when I think collectively we thought we were in some ways invincible to a lot of things. We're realizing we aren't, and we're realizing that we can forgive ourselves for not being invincible.
You live in Los Angeles for about 2 years now, and I've heard you say on the show that your street was, the phrase you used was, a little hot. And I think that was during the protests. What happened?
Yeah, well, funny enough, you can hear sirens on my street right now. I'll hold the mic
up. Yeah, I can.
It happens frequently these days. It's fine. So I've actually lived in L.A. for about 5 years altogether. But this is my second time here, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles, which kind of had a double whammy over the last few months. A lot of stuff shut down because of the pandemic. And then downtown was one of the epicenters of L.A. protests over police brutality. And over the course of the last few weeks, some places were looted. Protests were on my street. Things were boarded up. There was a curfew in L.A. for, gosh, well over a week. And it was just strange. But I think the weirdest night, it was a Sunday night. I heard the protesters come to my street. And I wanted to see it. I'm a journalist. So I leaned my head out the window. And I'm watching these protesters on my block. And the most of them are on the up and up, you know, just making their voices heard. Which I support. But there was this group of small kids, or not small kids, but like teenagers would look like, who weren't really affiliated with the protest itself. They were just kind of heckling. And one of them ended up, someone from somewhere, I think part of that group, threw a firework, like the random fireworks you have in your backyard on 4th of July. Mm. And it sparked up. And I was leaning out the window looking. Some of the sparks flew into my apartment. And I was not in danger. I was not worried. But it was just like, whoa. It's here. And I think that has been the reality of the news this year for everyone. More than in previous years, the news feels like it's right in your backyard, right on your front step, right in your neighborhood. Everyone is seeing how coronavirus is affecting everything right around them. Every major city and even small towns are seeing protests. We are in this in a way that feels much more top of mind and visceral and close, much closer than it has felt before. And so I'm grateful to be in a place like LA where I can see history being made as I speak with you. And I think it is very important and probably valuable that a lot of Americans feel closer to the news this year than they have in years before.
I wasn't going to bring this up earlier when you were talking about the sense of being invincible that everybody had, but people who were still going to work and were out and about in the world with all the heightened warnings also had some tremendous fear. And with the story you just told about the sparks coming into the apartment, I decided I was going to bring it up because we were so afraid of this unknown virus. Where was it? It was coming and going to kind of destroy our lives the way we were watching it destroy people and lives in New York and Italy and everywhere else. And it's easier now with things opening up, right? To feel that that fear is diminishing, but fear has been such a big part of all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's fear on multiple levels at this point. You know, we have seen over the last several years a growing number of Americans distrust major institutions, distrust the way our politics works. We lean more heavily into conspiracy theory, and that's shown itself in the way that we talk about and think about the pandemic. It's shown itself in the way that we are this week thinking about where all these fireworks are coming from. I think that there is, on top of just the fear of this moment, there's also a questioning of what to hold on to and what is real and what is fake in all of this. And I think they're connected. I think part of why there's a fear right now is because it feels like, while on the one hand there is information overload, on the other hand it's hard to tell from any day to the next who's actually telling the most truth, if that makes sense. You know, I go online to see what's trending, and half of my time on the internet is figuring out what to trust, not just informing myself. And it's gotten worse, I think, over the last few years. And so I think what I try to do with my show is to say, let's talk about how this news feels for all of us, how we're going to process it together. But also, let's say, what's true and what isn't? And I think that we have to lean into more truthful conversations on issues like health and safety, and especially things like race, where for so long we have danced around the truth and spoken in euphemism. And now is a time to just say what is.
You used that phrase, who's telling the most truth? Did you catch yourself saying that? Who's telling the most truth? One thing that seems to have come out of this George Floyd protest demonstration time is that a person's experience is their truth. It's not more or less. It's just, it's your life. It's your truth. And is that area gray for you at times? You're talking to people about their life experiences, but you're walking through this right now as a human being. I am, everybody is, and you have a very high profile responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the through lines of my show since the start was to find ways to have deep conversations about race with people of all races. And we've tried to do that a lot since the show started. And we've really leaned into having those conversations since these protests really kicked off. And on a certain level, there are certain truths that are true. But on another level, there are things that need to be worked out still. You know, I approach this story as a black man who has been profiled in the past by police. And I feel like it is appropriate in this moment for me to share that experience. I also have made a point over the last few weeks to talk with black people about how they're experiencing this. Black mothers giving the talk to their children. My own Aunt Betty talking about what it's like for her to fear for the men in her life, like myself. I've spoken with ministers talking about how they find hope in this moment of seeming despair. And so those truths I want to elevate. But I also want to have conversations about what we collectively, regardless of race, accept as truth when these stories keep happening, when the George Floyds of America keep being killed at the hands of the police. One of the big conversations that I and other journalists are having right now is, when these events happen, is it fair to write a story about an officer-involved killing where only a police report is quoted? I think for the longest time, the assumption of most newsrooms was, if the police said it, that's what we report and we accept it as fact. And I think the last few years of stories like these have taught us that it's probably best for us to second guess even that and to do our due diligence on what even the authorities are telling us. And I think we weren't in that place a few years ago, but I think we should have been. And I think those are the questions of, you know, the more truth that I'm asking right now. How do we as journalists remain empathetic but also skeptical? You know, we need to stay skeptical of all the sides in these big, tough conversations. And that is a challenge for me in my work right now.
I'm talking with Sam Sanders from NPR. His show and his podcast, It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders, will become part of Cap Radio's Saturday lineup. It will air at 11 a.m. on Saturdays, right between Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and This American Life.
I'm honored to be there. That is prime real estate. Thank y'all for having me.
Sam, what did you learn about authentic conversation, maybe I should call it audience engagement, during the 2016 election cycle and then into the Trump presidency, when again the country was so highly charged, but you had the opportunity to talk to so many different people coming from so many different viewpoints?
Yeah, I think what I experienced on the trail was that most people are nicer than you think. And we see these visuals of anger so much in the news, but pound for pound, most people are trying to get through their days and not be too much of a mean person. And so my experience on the trail was that, and people were nice to me in spaces where you wouldn't expect them to be nice to someone like me. I think in the aftermath of the election, conversations for my show and just out in the real world, people wanted to connect with me more and trusted me more if I admitted that I, too, did not have all the answers and did not know what happens next. There was a moment when I think we looked to news and to journalists to tell us everything and what was going to happen next. And I think my version of journalism is not that. My version of journalism is to say, here's what I know. Here's how I feel. How do you feel? None of us knows what's going to happen next, but let's brace ourselves with a certain amount of clear facts and walk into whatever this future is together. I think having that perspective and taking off the ego of the voice of God journalist and just saying, I'm here with you with all the questions you have, that's led to richer conversations, and it's led to, I think, a pretty good show where I'm holding hands with my audience. I am not preaching at them, if that makes sense.
Were you a youngster who talked a lot? And who did you talk to? Who did you like to talk to when you were young?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny. I wasn't particularly that much of a talker as a kid. I had a very severe stutter, so I kind of lived in my head a lot because I wasn't talking a lot out loud unless I was forced to. But my brother and I, we were devoted television watchers. And I remember watching all of the late night shows and the talk shows and just marveling at all of those folks and being really immersed in the idea of what it means to have a good conversation. My brother and I, as kids, I remember this vividly. 7 or 8, we'd be in front of the mirror brushing our teeth before school, and we'd pretend that we were hosting like an interview show. And we'd push the other out of the way and hold our toothbrushes as mics and ask fake questions to fake people. And I've never forgotten that. And yeah, I was always just really into that. And it's funny, now I want to make a show with my brother where we both host a show together, telling that story to you.
You've got your Aunt Betty on the show regularly. You could bring your brother on.
Yeah. And it's so great to have her there.
If you were into television, it's such a visual medium, and you're looking at yourselves in the mirror. What about face masks right now and communicating with people? I don't have any issue with the safety and how important they are, but we all bump up against that. Trying to talk to someone, it's a little bit muffled. The conversation doesn't flow the same way. And maybe it sometimes feels like a shield to what we want to express to each other. How's that going for you?
Oh, man, I've had so many conflicted thoughts about the face mask. And I'm glad you asked that question because I'm still working my way through it. I think in some ways it's forced us to be more direct, you know, where you would used to walk down the street and if you made eye contact with someone, you might nod. Now there's a pressure, if eye contact is made, to say audibly and maybe even loudly, hello. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's nice to say hello, right? So I like that. But on the other hand, I have thought a lot about what the face mask means for me as a black man. So I remember when we were all first asked to wear them, I said, well, should I be worried? Will people see me and think differently of, and they think the worst of a black guy in a mask? But then when I started doing it, I felt a certain relief of pressure. It was really weird. So a lot of times, and I'm sure you might feel the same way as a woman, you are expected to offer a sort of visual performance to other people to let them know that you aren't a shrill or mean or angry woman or a threatening or harmful black man. So I would find myself walking through the world all the time smiling more than I needed to just to put people at ease. And I'm sure you have had to do that as a woman, right? And what I found, as soon as I had the mask on, I didn't have to fake that anymore. It could just be my face for me. And so in this odd way, the mask has been quite liberating for me as a black man. And I kind of like it. It feels weird to say it out loud, but
wow,
I do.
I'm so glad you said all that. Wow.
Do you feel that, though? Because it's there is a kind of performance we're asked to do as certain types of people.
So here's the part that I experienced as a woman. And in a show that used to be hosted in the studio, I used to run up against kind of a conflict between how do I say thank you or goodbye or hello? Do I shake hands? Do I hug? What's the expectation? I have to decide it. I have to kind of drive those decisions with my body language choices. And I would feel sort of a, I don't know, like a whole body consciousness about it. As soon as we had to be careful and keep 6 feet of distance or 10 feet of distance, I felt safer. I felt like something was decided for me. Sam, I've not ever said this to anybody other than my family, but I liked
I'm
that
glad
requirement.
You're saying it.
It made my life easier.
Yes. And these are the conversations to have. I think that, like, as awkward as this national moment is for us, it is revealing some truths and helping a lot of folks say some things that maybe haven't been said before, like your experience with that and my experience with my face in public. And I think those are good conversations to have. I find it fascinating.
Well, I can't talk to
you.
I can't talk to you about the show without talking about the laughter, because your conversation, your shows, they have so much laughter in them. What's happened to laughing since March of this year?
We still do it, but there's less of it. We still laugh. You know, I would tell folks before the pandemic began that, like, our show was trying in a very good and smart way to put a laugh track on the week's news to help you catch up on what you missed and then to help you find humor amidst all of the chaos, right? But after the pandemic and now the protest, our mission has shifted a bit. We are not just trying to make sure that folks get a laugh. We are trying to make sure that we are emotionally available to our listeners to offer them the chance to also have a good cry. And we have had some segments over the last few weeks in which we have very heartfelt, touching, emotional conversations that we know are going to be tearjerkers, but we think that people need the chance for that catharsis. I had a conversation after George Floyd's death with a colleague of mine, a black woman. She has three black boys, and she talked about having to give the talk to them all the time, over and over and over. And it was heartbreaking. You know, when the pandemic hit, we talked with a home health aide who didn't have enough gloves and masks to see all of her patients at their houses, so she would recycle them. And she had baggies for each of their respective gloves and masks in the back of her car. And she couldn't stop her job because if she didn't go to see her patients, they would die. And I think that it's been important for us to have that there because people need a space in which they can express their sorrow and their grief and let it out. So in the same way that before this pandemic, I wanted to be a chance where folks can let the laugh out, right now I want this show to be a space where folks can have a good ugly cry if they need to, but we still laugh as well. I can't help but laugh. I'm a laugher. Things are funny. Things are just funny.
That is very true. And then you do one more thing that I think is just magical. I'm all for it. You end the show with the best thing that happened in the week. On Insight, we call it the uplift. At our dinner table, we call it the high-low. And you can have as many highs in the day as you want.
Yeah.
So yeah. Tell me about that idea of the best thing that happened in the week.
Yeah. So years ago on Facebook, I saw a friend or two every Friday ask their Facebook friends to share in the comments to the post the best part of their week. And it could be anything. A graduation, a first date, you cooked a great cake, your favorite TV show was on, whatever. And I liked it. So I began to do it on my Facebook page, and I did this for years. And when we were launching the show about 3 years ago, we had a bunch of brainstorming meetings to figure out what segments would be a part of the show. And we just asked friends and colleagues, what are your ideas? And a good friend of mine, former colleague Theo Balcom, she said, Sam, you know that best things thing you do on your Facebook? What if you could do it on the radio? And I looked at my producer, Brent Bachman, and he was like, that sounds good. And I said, yeah, that sounds good. And Brent made it work. And we just began to ask listeners to record voice memos sharing the best parts of their week. And we hear a bit of everything. A lot of childbirth, a lot of graduations, a lot of cancer remission, a lot of running marathons, a lot of celebration and joy. One of my favorites, this was a year or two ago now, a young man who had been colorblind his whole life. His friends took him to the Grand Canyon and surprised him with a pair of glasses that could help him see color. And he first saw color while in the Grand Canyon. And he recorded a voice memo from there in that first moment of seeing color. And it gives me chills to this day just to talk about it. But that's the kind of stuff that we close our show with every week, because it's good to celebrate the good stuff like that.
Well, it's a great thought to close this conversation, too. So I can't think of any other better way to leave it. And I wish you so much good health, good happiness, you know, all the good stuff in life, because certainly we are all having to walk through a lot of the other stuff too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tell you what, this is one of the high points of my week. I really enjoyed reconnecting, and I thank you for this thoughtful conversation. And when all the crazy is over, I'm going to come back up there and say hi in person.
Oh, good. Well, it's been a high for us too, for me personally. Thank you so much, Sam. Take care.
All right, you too. Thank you.
Sam Sanders from NPR. His show and podcast, It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders, is becoming part of Cap Radio's Saturday lineup. It will air at 11 a.m. on Saturdays, right between Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and This American Life. So again, the warmest thank you to Sam. Thanks to our engineers at Cap Radio, too, and at NPR West for helping us with that conversation yesterday. It is one of those that I am always going to remember. So you can find out more about Sam, about the show, and the weekend programming, which is changing in ways that I hope you love. That's all at capradio.org. And that's Insight for this week. Oh, a couple notes here. Governor Newsom has a statewide press conference at noon today. You're going to hear it live on Cap Radio. One more note related to my conversation with Chris Nichols about face masks. He's right that for the most part, you don't need them outside. However, if you can't keep that physical distance of at least 6 feet from people who are not part of your family or your household or your residence, then you are supposed to wear the mask. So the point is, like Dr. Fauci says, don't congregate closely. And if you are going to congregate, wear the mask. Most of all, stay aware and stay safe. Next week on Insight, Ken Rudin, the political junkie, joins me Monday. On Wednesday, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction writer Colson Whitehead. I'm Beth Ruyak with producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Chris Vera Phillips. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer, Devin Cortan. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Take care and stay aware.